Welcome to the Actionable Futurist podcast, a show all about the near-term future with practical and actionable advice from a range of global experts to help you stay ahead of the curve. Every episode answers the question, what's the future of? With voices and opinions that need to be heard. Your host is international keynote speaker and actionable futurist Andrew Grill.
My guest today is Sofia Matveeva, the CEO and founder of Tech for Non-Techies, an education company and consultancy. Sofia has contributed to the Harvard Business Review, Financial Times, The Guardian, and Forbes on entrepreneurship and technology, and hosts the top-rated Tech for Non-Techies podcast. And you can hear me on her show, episode 110. It was a great chat. Sofia is a startup mentor at the Chicago Booth Polsky Center of Entrepreneurship and has advised leading accelerators, including Chicago Booth's New Venture Challenge and the Microsoft London College of Fashion Incubator. She holds an MBA from Chicago Booth and a BSc in politics from Bristol. Sofia is fluent in English, Russian, and French. Welcome, Sofia.
Hello, Andrew. It is so wonderful to be here. I loved the chat that we had on my podcast, and I'm honored to be continuing our conversation.
Well, we did some swapsies when we ran into each other again at COGEX, which is a big AI festival run in London. We did a swapsie, said, if I come on yours, you can come on mine, and you got me first. And amazingly, we're just talking off air, you edited it in about 8 hours. We spoke late, probably about the same time in the afternoon on a Monday, and I think Tuesday morning it was up. And I was very impressed because I normally take a bit longer to edit. So you beat me there, and you now spurn me to edit my podcast more rapidly. So thank you for that. It was a great chat.
Thank you.
Now, your own personal journey is fascinating. Could you share the story of how you made your way to London? And then we might reverse engineer and work out why Tech for Non-Techies exists.
I came to London quite a long time ago, Andrew. So I was born in Moscow, and my mother started working at the London School of Economics. And she brought me over when I was a kid. And so I went to school in the UK, in London, and then university in the UK, the US, University of Chicago, then Sorbonne in Paris. Started my career working in London, and I worked at Finsbury, which is one of the top financial PR companies. And so we're working on M&A, IPO, literally nothing to do with technology. The tech sector wasn't really a thing then. I graduated from university with my first degree in 2005. And that's literally when Facebook was founded a year before that. So, you know, I think a lot of people my age, we went into banking, we went into consultancy, or maybe advertising. Only kind of a few people like you, Andrew, went into tech, but that was kind of left field. And so I worked in the media, and then I worked in private equity. And that's when I was thinking, oh, tech is kind of becoming a thing. This is where the innovation is happening. Also, this is where the money is. And what the hell am I doing in this private equity firm? And then I moved to India for a bit, and I went to do my MBA at Chicago Booth. So I returned to the University of Chicago. And my aim was to really use this MBA to completely transform my career and to transition into tech. And I now actually, you know, I've taught at business schools, and I see that a lot of MBA students want to follow the same route, but actually that route is still not as easy as I think it should be, because the tech industry is so new, it's so young, and, you know, they're still training on their recruitment processes. So for example, Goldman Sachs or McKinsey, they have been recruiting MBAs from Harvard and Stanford and Chicago Booth for decades. They know exactly how to get you on the conveyor belt, how to seduce you into applying, and what to do with you once you get in. Whereas, you know, Google and Amazon, yes, they're still some of the biggest recruiters right now of MBA students, but they're still kind of learning on the job, you know, and as an MBA student, you are the job. When I was doing my MBA, I was thinking, okay, I need to get into this tech industry. This is where the money is. This is where the excitement is. But, you know, I was feeling like this person who's just discovered fire, because I think I don't know anything about it and I don't know how to go about it. And so I was applying for jobs, but also I was thinking what I really want to do is actually start a business. Like, if I could choose, this is what I'd want to do. And I worked with a team. We actually came up with an idea. We went through one of the top accelerators in the US. We actually did raise some money. And that's how I ended up transitioning to tech. So I transitioned into tech by entrepreneurship, which is definitely effective, but I would say it's probably the most violent way of doing it. Because when you are an entrepreneur, you really don't know, you know, when you're a first-time entrepreneur, you don't know anything about anything. You don't know how to run a business. You don't know how to bill a client. You don't know anything. So kind of putting on top of that, what is an API? How do you hire developers? How much do you need to know about code as a non-technical founder? You know, I really just decided to drink from the fire hose. And so it's definitely possible to do it that way, but I do want the audience to know that there are easier ways.
Now, I listened to a recent podcast. It was actually episode 100, and you said, I'm going to actually talk about myself today. And it was really interesting. Some of what you've said already was on that podcast, but a couple of things really jumped out at me. When you're going for funding and talking to VCs, they said, well, you've got a tech company, you haven't got a tech background, you haven't got a tech founder. So why are you even talking to us? And I suppose that stereotype, that resistance is something that you're helping to break down because you started a tech company without a tech background. We'll talk about the need for digital literacy. On episode 110, I talked about the fact that I went from being a techie to a business developer and a CEO. I have the understanding of the technology, but I haven't coded for years. You actually went and did some coding courses. You sort of looked at what you have to do, short of going and getting an engineering degree, I need to be able to code. Tell me about the story with the VC saying, you know, we've said no because you haven't got a tech background, you're not a tech founder. And then what was the value in doing those coding courses? And would you suggest other people do that? Or is there a shortcut?
With the investors, I think it's so tempting for startup founders when you're fundraising, because fundraising is awful. You know, you've got your idea, you're already pretty sensitive about it, and you kind of know about all of the disasters you've got in your inbox. And then you're going to all of these people who are essentially kind of like, you know, imagine like a Roman king kind of putting their thumb up or usually down, and you walk away just feeling really, really terrible. So it's so tempting to just say, VCs are stupid and I'm amazing and they didn't, you know, they're stupid that they didn't see whatever, how great I am. So, I mean, let's say maybe that's partially the truth. But really, I also think that it is reasonable for investors to be more skeptical of non-technical founders of tech companies. The reason is that when you don't know how to either build something yourself or you don't know how a product gets built, you can end up wasting your money. So you could make the wrong hire. You could hire somebody who is maybe unscrupulous. You know, you could just go to Upwork, find a bunch of developers who will say, sure, we'll build it for you. And because you don't even know how to track progress, they could take your money and go. Or they could deliver something completely different and you wouldn't know what to do with it. So kind of the potential to waste money as a non-technical founder at the beginning is much higher than for a technical founder. I think that potential gets reversed later on because non-technical founders, you know, if they have a business background, are usually better at sales, are usually better at marketing. So they are actually going to be able to understand how to allocate capital when it comes to growth in a much better way than the technical founders. But right at the beginning, you're not worrying about growth because you don't have a thing to grow. So I do think that investors are perfectly reasonable to think, well, if you're a non-technical founder, how do I know you're not going to take my money and basically make a bunch of very typical mistakes? And my answer to that is, well, investors don't actually care whether you go home and build the thing with your bare hands. What investors care about is a financial return.
You're talking about you'd actually done some Python course and things like that. And the question was, is that something that you need to do? And the reasons behind doing that, because you felt compelled that, well, I've got to have a technical understanding of all this stuff.
I took so many courses in my transition into tech because as a non-technical person, I think I was completely ridden with insecurity and I was so focused on learning as much as I could. And I actually think that it can be self-defeating. So people who are smart and people who are ambitious, people who are used to working hard, we tend to sign up for pretty much every course, try to read every book, and that's not a good use of your time. So for example, I signed up to a Computer Science 101 course from Stanford online. And on it, we even looked inside the hard drive. Like, how is a hard drive made? And I remember thinking, okay, well, maybe if I finish this course, like when I finish it, I'll be able to really understand what the developers on my team are talking about. And honestly, I really didn't. Like, taking apart the hard drive did not help me at all. I also, in that course, I spent 3 hours coding a little black square into a little blue square. Okay, I actually would argue that that was a very, very frustrating experience, but that was actually helpful. So I think that as a non-technical person, it's definitely helpful to take courses. So of course, I would say that I actually teach courses. I teach tech for non-technical founders and how to speak tech for leaders. But I actually don't teach coding. I'm a terrible coder. I don't know how to do it. Definitely don't ever take any coding courses from me. And I think for most non-technical people, you could do a boot camp. So take a 3-hour course or maybe take a day just to understand how does it actually work. So you could actually see code. You could see what is a syntax error. How do you end up putting bugs into a line of code without you even understanding what you're doing? Just, you know, it's a day. It's not going to cost you too much. You probably won't like it, but that's okay. You know, you can survive 6 hours of not really enjoying yourself, kind of for the benefit of your career. Or if 6 hours sounds too painful, you could take a 3-hour coding course, literally to just understand what it is. I wouldn't necessarily go beyond that unless you take that 3-hour course and you really find that actually you have an affinity for it. Because as a leader in today's age, you don't actually need to build this stuff with your bare hands, as what I was saying about the VC point. But you need to know how to hire the right people, how to set them the right tasks, how to see whether people are on track, because that's an allocation of capital and that's an allocation of energy. That's what I call being a digital collaborator, being a digital leader. And that doesn't actually mean that you have to learn to code. And if you do try to learn to code, my question is, what language are you going to pick? Because, you know, if you don't know the difference between a back end and a front end, how are you going to choose what coding language is going to be relevant for you?
I actually heard in a conference a few years ago, someone who was a senior leader in a real estate business said he'd gone off and done a sort of a 6-week cybersecurity course. Now, he's not going to be a cybersecurity expert. And I think the courses you run and the courses that are out there are becoming more and more important. They need you to have a level of, I call it digital curiosity. You're comfortable saying, oh, cybersecurity. So I need to worry about an endpoint. What's an endpoint? Oh, that's a laptop and how we secure those sort of things. I think it busts some of the jargon because I think some of the challenges were where you have the non-techies meet the techies. They speak a different language and that's almost having an understanding. Now, I speak very bad French, but I could probably ask for directions and get myself out of trouble. So I have an understanding of whether I'm being told something that is right or wrong because of my basic understanding. I would expect you would have a much higher proficiency of French and get yourself out of trouble all the time. But I wanted to put to you that the digital curiosity, rather than having a master's degree in engineering, is it sensible for executives or any level of company to have this level of understanding? So obviously for entrepreneurs, it's important and you worked out that balance of how much do I need to know to be effective? But I imagine a lot of people listen to your podcast, a lot of people listen to my podcast, are mid to senior level executives who are feeling a bit overwhelmed with all this jargon. So how do we get them to a level where they feel comfortable what they're being told is roughly correct?
So one of the things that I think we all need to accept is that it's a constantly moving target, unfortunately, which is great for podcasters like me and you, Andrew, because we've always got material to put out. But there is always going to be something new, and you do have to be discerning about what's kind of worth you learning and what's not, and also where do you start? Because, for example, as we talked offline before, lots of people are talking about the metaverse and crypto, but if you don't know the basics of what is an API, how can opening APIs can help you grow your business, or how do you question data, how is an algorithm made? If you don't know how that stuff works, then definitely the metaverse and crypto is too much. So first of all, executives, leaders, I do believe that, unfortunately, it's another thing that we have to learn. But, you know, in a way that whether you are an oil industry executive or whether you're running a hospital or you're selling beer, we all agree that you need to have communication skills and you probably need to take a leadership course. So all these executives go and take leadership courses. Great. I agree that that's necessary. But now in the digital age, you also would need to take a course like the one I teach, which is How to Speak Tech for Leaders, which teaches you to be a digital collaborator. So I do think that, first of all, you do need to learn core terminology, kind of like in the language. You know, if you are, imagine if, you know, you'd never been to France before and you're going to go there and you are told that actually you're going to a tiny village where nobody speaks English and you have to, you know, just get around in your hotel, order some food, just do some basic things. You would probably sign up to Rosetta Stone or you'll get a teacher, you would learn some words. But if you only sit there by yourself learning words and you never speak to a French person, you're never going to get that good at the language. So the next stage I'd say for executives is, yes, learn the course and listen to a podcast, but then actually speak to a technologist. And when they say words that you don't understand, which they will, because there is this divide, then ask them questions. Because remember, at the end of the day, technology is a tool, and technology is a tool that we use for a particular business purpose. So if you are working in a business, presumably you know your specialty. So you could literally say, well, how does it help us drive, you know, our quarterly goals? How does this help us grow revenue or increase efficiency? Or how does this help us drive customer satisfaction? And this will teach you, but also the benefits of that conversation is that it will teach the technologists to think more in business terms. Because what you're saying, Andrew, is so right, is that there is this divide, but the divide is felt by both sides. And I'm curious what you think here, because I've met so many wonderful, smart, and ambitious engineers who just really want to understand, okay, what are investors looking for? What's happening to our stock price? And what's this legal talk? Like, can somebody explain the business side, the revenue worries? Like, what are we doing with our advertising campaigns? And so I actually think that the more we speak to each other, the more we ask each other questions, the better all of our companies will be.
Comes back to my notion of being curious. You can be digitally curious, you can be financially curious. I was lucky that I grew up in a small business family. So we were having discussions around the kitchen table about profit and loss, about hiring and firing, about, you know, cash flow and those sort of things. And so I would ask my father, well, what's cash flow? What does it mean? Why is it good to have it? And those sort of things. And I think you're right. A lot of engineers want to know this. And I think it's also on our executives, the people listening to our podcast, to say, let's actually give both sides a level of understanding. Let's raise the level of understanding on both sides. Because when my engineers are standing in a circle at a scrum meeting because they have to race to get something done, if they truly understand why they're doing that, if we get it delivered 3 days earlier, we beat our competitors to market, we're likely to have a better share price, your options will be worth more, we'll have more people buying your product, they'll be happier, you'll actually get to enhance that. I think we sometimes don't tell people the whole picture because, well, they're techies, they don't need to know about finance. But I think from both sides, the financial or the management side, when you say I need it done in 3 days, it's nearly impossible because I've got to go and do this and that and the other. And in fact, you haven't funded us to be able to go and get another cloud server, et cetera, et cetera. So I think you're very right that both sides need to have a better level of understanding of what each other does. But back to what you're doing, I imagine the reason you set up your business and the niche you're in is you couldn't find anyone else that was doing what you were doing. And so you said, I'm going to do it myself.
Sort of. But you're making me sound far more thoughtful than actually the process showed me to be. In my first company, which was a retail tech business, which unfortunately we had to close during the pandemic, but it launched me into the tech space. And then I was thinking, well, I don't know what I'm doing. So I took all of these courses, as I said, but I was also writing for Forbes. I had a column in Forbes and I thought, oh, brilliant. I'm going to use it as free consulting. I'm going to interview all of these very successful, non-technical people succeeding in tech, either as founders or investors or as corporate leaders. And interview them for Forbes and basically just ask them all the things I want to know. And those articles did really well. And people started reading them and then asking me to give talks. And all of a sudden, I became sort of the patron saint of non-technical people in tech, which was never, you know, I never had a business plan. This was never an intention. And actually, it was something that I felt incredibly insecure about. And then I started charging for the talks. And then I thought, oh, people aren't paying me. So I had to start a business. And during the pandemic, people wanted to learn more and more. And by that point, I'd already been doing a lot of speaking and teaching just as myself. But, you know, as you grow, you need to get a team around you. It needs to become more than just you. And essentially, this is how Tech for Non-Techies was born. So it was really born out of demand rather than smart planning.
I'm an entrepreneur or I'm a senior leader and I've come across your website or this podcast. What can I learn by doing one of your courses and what can I do next with the information that you impart to me?
All of our customers are basically the same kind of person. They're always smart. They're always ambitious. They don't have a background in tech and they want to use technology for a particular aim. So for example, they are leading digital transformation at a large corporate. They probably need to learn some core terminology themselves because a lot of the time, you know, they're coming maybe from McKinsey where they know strategy, but they need to brush up on their tech terms. But then they also need to bring the rest of the organization with them, which means that they need a corporate learning program, which is something that we would do for their non-technical teams. So their teams understand what on earth this digital transformation is about, why there are random new people in jeans standing around in something called a scrum meeting, what a scrum meeting is, and how you can participate in it, and why it's actually going to be good for you, and why it's not about robots taking your jobs and bad things happening. So that's on the corporate level. On the personal level, we work with individuals. So for example, we quite often see either people who have an idea for a startup and they think, well, I've got this idea. I don't have a technical background. I could probably raise money or, you know, let me deal with that later. But before I even think about raising money, I need to understand how to bring this product to market. What do I need to do? So with that, we would teach this person, we would teach them the Tech for Non-Technical Founders course. Now what we found is people need to combine coaching with the courses because all of us could learn all of this information, but unless you actually then put it into practice and you really consciously learn, you know, you do your user testing, you make a prototype, you get feedback on your prototype, you actually know how to analyze that feedback to move to the next stage. You know, unless you know how to do that, unless somebody leads you through that, the course might not be, it won't be a complete experience. And we also, what we've noticed specifically in the UK, and I'm curious here what you think, Andrew, we started working with investors because investors were taking our courses for non-technical founders because they were saying, well, you know, my background is, again, in management consulting or in banking, but now I need to invest in tech. What am I supposed to do? The only thing that they saw was available for people like them was my non-technical founders course. Because what I find is that there are either courses that are basically learn to code, become a data scientist, become a full-on techie, or something which is much more on the leadership side, you know, how do you lead in the digital age? Whereas what Tech for Non-Techies does is somewhere in the middle. And there's nobody else doing that. We usually combine it with coaching. And in the end, they can either become smart money investors, launch their tech businesses, or help their companies go through large-scale digital transformation with the rest of their workforce on board.
To answer your question, I think there are a lot of roles for people who have a dual mindset. So I've been doing a lot of work over the last few years where I've been doing some due diligence. So someone says, we're interested in this company. What do you think? Or we have a bunch of companies that we could potentially invest in. Can you go through and look at which ones might be the right one? And the challenge is you have to have a techie brain to understand the technology to see whether it's viable and valuable. But then again, you have to have a business brain to know, well, what might the return be? What's the margin on the product? What else is out there? And those sort of things. So I think there are multiple roles. You're serving a need where people are saying, I need to know this quickly and I need to start applying it. And then they go back into their job and they're a lot more comfortable because the jargon they're hearing, they know about. And hopefully what they're then doing is obviously sending more people onto your courses from their organization, but also hopefully telling people what they've learned and how they can actually access this sort of bridge between the techie and the non-techie. So I think there's a huge opportunity there because not everyone can go and do a full-on technical course and not everyone can go and do an MBA. So I think there is a hybrid out there. And the challenge is, to your point, How do you find people that can straddle both divides, can talk techie to the techs and talk business to the business people? I think I gave an example on your podcast that years ago at Optus in Australia, I was dealing with some people who were selling us some equipment. We were rolling out a huge network and they started to tell me things that couldn't be done. They said, we just can't do this. And I then let slip that I was actually a techie and the whole mood changed because then it was peers talking to peers and they realized they couldn't pull the wool over my eyes. So it sometimes helped having a financially savvy techie on the team or the reverse, a techie who understands finance and vice versa. But I think we're seeing more and more of this. And I think you've said it when we spoke last time, every company these days is a technology company. So whether you like it or not, the terminology that's used won't go away. There will be business language, there'll be technology language, but every single thing that we do has a technological thing. When I got my first mobile phone, it was a Nokia device. It was an instruction manual that was several pages thick. These days, the tech companies assume that you know how to use these things. They also assume that you know how to invest, you know how to build technical solutions when maybe there is no instruction manual. It sounds like what you're doing is giving them a bit of an instruction manual.
An instruction manual, but also we tell people when it's okay to not know everything. This is really actually one of the critical skills. Oh, by the way, speaking of jargon, I've actually created a quick ebook that you can get, which lists the top 10 tech terms that every non-technical leader needs to know. So you can just go to the Tech for Non-Techies website and you'll get it there. It's techfornontechies.co. Obviously, if I'm creating an ebook, I'm only going to stop with, 10 terms, otherwise we'll go on forever. Ambitious people have this tendency, and I'm one of them, to think, well, okay, maybe it's not 10. Maybe I need to learn 250. What am I supposed to do? I will take all the qualifications. I will do all of the things. But in reality, Andrew, our audiences are very similar. They've actually got very, very full-on full-time jobs. These are senior people making big decisions. But also apart from that, they usually have families, maybe a hobby, and, occasionally they'd like to sleep. So it's unrealistic to basically try to learn everything. And this is one of the things that I really want people to understand is that, yes, you need to understand, you need to be able to speak tech, you need to be a good digital collaborator. But what I like to say to people is, imagine if you were to hire a lawyer, would you think, oh, I need to go to law school to hire a lawyer? You wouldn't, because that's the whole point of hiring a lawyer. They've gone to law school and you haven't. You do need to understand some basic legal terminology so you don't end up hiring a divorce lawyer to handle your M&A deal. You do need to understand, that there are differences. There's a criminal barrister in the UK, which is different from a solicitor. So you need to understand some basic words so you make the right hires, but you don't actually need to do a law degree. But for some reason, when it comes to technology, we think, oh, I can't work with a tech team unless I've learned how to do all the stuff myself. We are raising the bar, which I think is kind of unreasonable.
The reason why we are confused by technology is it's everywhere. So you're right. The few times a year when I need to engage a lawyer, and hopefully not very often, I need to know something about how to engage them. And I let them do it because they're experts. Whereas I think because we are surrounded by technology, you and I are talking over Riverside FM. I've got a camera in front of me, microphone, all that sort of stuff. Every day we're being asked to learn things all the time. And I think that's why it sometimes becomes a bit overloading. But clearly you've got a way of demystifying that. I wanted to just move on to your career because it sounds like you've, like me, pivoted a few times. What's the hardest lesson you've learned in business to date?
I would say that it is outsourcing my decision making to other people, because at the end of the day, we want to take advice. Advice is good, but the role of advice is for us to take other people's point of view and then to decide what we think about it, not to take other people's advice basically as an order. In my first company, I remember one of my company's advisors said that there's an accelerator we should participate in. And I looked at it and I remember thinking, well, it doesn't sound very good. It doesn't sound like what they're going to give us is going to be very useful. And I don't think they really have the right experience. But then I was thinking, well, he's invested in lots of companies and this is my first one. And I really don't know kind of what I'm doing. So I should listen to him, even though actually this decision really makes no sense to me. So I did listen to him and I turned out to be right. The accelerator was full of basically corporate people who had no idea how to work with technology. It was an attempt at corporate innovation, which went completely terribly wrong. And whose fault was it? I was the CEO at the end of the day, the decision was mine. And so the decision, so I wasn't going to blame somebody for it. And that really was a lesson for me that if something does not make sense to you and there is somebody who is saying, no, 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 you should do it, well, either continue investigating, you know, don't just think, well, I don't know what I'm doing, this other person does, because if you turn out to be right, there's nothing you can do. At the end of the day, this is going to be your mistake. And saying, oh, he told me to, that's not something that you can do or not something that you should do as a leader. So if something doesn't make sense, investigate it and don't just outsource your decision-making to other people, no matter how smart they seem to be. One of my peers and one of my great friends runs a Fortune 100 company in the US. It's one of the largest companies listed on the New York Stock Exchange. He gives me advice on things. I give him advice on things. We're friends, so this is not a money exchange situation. We are peers. One of my wonderful mentors is Emma Sinclair, who runs Enterprise Alumni. She'd IPO'd her first company on the London Stock Exchange before the age of 30. Again, if I am stuck on something or I don't know how to negotiate something, she's somebody I'll send a WhatsApp message to.
Now, I want to delve into the world of podcasts because I had Tiger from Genpact. He said that one of the ways he stays up to date and relevant is by listening to lots of podcasts. And he started listening to a few. And he actually said he listens to probably 15 hours a week of podcasts. And he does them while he's out doing something. And that's a great way to consume content. What's been the reaction to your podcast? And is this one of the main ways that you get your message out, aside from Harvard Business Review and Forbes and those sort of things? How are you getting the tech for non-techies message out there? And how important is the podcast to do that?
I'd say the podcast is really important for people who've already met me. So in general, you can say the customer flow goes from, you know, I speak at an event or somebody meets me somewhere or I write an article, say for the Harvard Business Review. And then, and you know, we all do this. You read something or you see somebody who's interesting and you think, oh, this is interesting. I want to know more. Most of the time, none of us are ready to say, okay, you know, here's lots of money, start changing my organization to become, to change their digital mindset. Most of the time what happens is people think, well, I want to know more. And I think a podcast is a really great way for people to then carry on learning from me. Some of them, of course, end up becoming customers. A lot of them don't, but that's fine. Because, you know, some of them are going to, you know, I know some of them write to me, they are currently undergrad students. I'm not going to expect them to sign a check for a corporate program. But some of them reach out and they say, you know, I am the head of innovation at so-and-so. Would you be able to come and help our team get up to date with the digital mindset? And so I think the podcast is more of a way for people to get to know me and to understand what I'm teaching and also to understand my very specific philosophy on how much do you really need to know about technology in order to succeed in the digital age and when can you stop? Because we have to be realistic with the time that we have here on Earth.
So you're proudly non-techie. What's the best thing about being a non-techie?
That's an interesting question. I think there are wonderful things about being, essentially what we're not gives us the opportunity to be something that we are. So I love what I actually do. So I love the marketing side. I love creating content. I love teaching. I love also working with clients one-on-one. So for example, one of my clients right now, she's a pediatric dentist and she has created an app with my help to help her tiny patients basically take photos of their teeth. And so she can do telemedicine and now other dentists are using it too. So I love working with my clients. And because this is what I really, really enjoy doing, it takes up all of my time. If I was also attempting to learn Python and C++ and also to become a great UX designer, I wouldn't actually have the time to do what I love and what I'm good at. And so I think this is the best thing. When we decide what we are, it also means that we decide what we're not. So for example, if you decide that you're a parent, that means that, okay, you know, your nights out of random Tuesday night fun are probably going to end, at least for a bit. So this is, I think, you know, when you're a non-techie, you're making a choice. But equally, when you're a technical person, as you said, Andrew, you need to keep on, you need to keep up with the latest trends. So how far can you go into the business world if you are going to be, say, the best network engineer? It's just impossible for you to be the best network engineer and also to be the best marketer at the same time. In one lifetime, none of us can do that.
We're almost out of time, so I want to run you through my favorite part of the show, which I call the quick fire round. We're going to fire some quick questions at you, so a short answer is a good answer. iPhone or Android?
iPhone, definitely.
Window or aisle?
Window.
Online or in the room?
In the room, as much as possible.
What's the app you use most on your phone?
WhatsApp.
The one thing you won't be doing again post-pandemic?
A bachelorette party on Zoom. It was horrible.
What's the best piece of advice you've ever received?
Look for the opportunity in everything.
What are you reading at the moment?
A wonderful book called Clara and the Sun by Kazuo Ishiguro.
Who should I invite next onto the podcast?
Oh, you will love David Wells, who was the CFO of Netflix. He was at Netflix for 14 years. He was on my podcast. He can talk to you about the inside scoop of how Netflix grew from a DVD rental to the streaming game of today. So he's got gossip on technology and on Hollywood. He's a great guest.
David, check your inbox. And final question for our quickfire round. How do you want to be remembered?
As an intellectual behemoth.
That's a unique answer. I like that. As this is the Actionable Futurist podcast, what three actionable things should our audience do today when it comes to demystifying technology?
First thing is go and speak to a technologist. Actually speak to them and just say, what are you working on and how does that impact the business? Say those words, see what happens. So that's one. Number two, it's kind of what you're already doing. Listen to Andrew's podcast, listen to my podcast, carry on learning. The final thing is I'd say, if you're a non-technical person, find other non-technical people who have succeeded in tech. And here, I've got lots of examples on my podcast, but you have to put in an effort because most of the people you hear from, most of the people you hear about, they're the Elon Musks, they are the Mark Zuckerbergs. So you hear the story of an engineer, basically a developer turned CEO. But that is not the only story. There are plenty of non-technical people succeeding and leading in tech, but that's not what the media in general is reporting. So you just have to dig a bit deeper to find them.
How can people find out more about you and your work?
Follow me on LinkedIn, listen to the Tech for Non-Techies podcast, and say hi to me on Twitter, Sophia Matveeva.
Sophia, a great chat. I'm so glad we ran into each other again at CogX, and I'm glad that you had me on your podcast and you've been on mine. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Andrew. Wonderful questions. I love speaking to you.
Thank you for listening to the Actionable Futurist podcast. You can find all of our previous shows at actionablefuturist.com. And if you like what you've heard on the show, please consider subscribing via your favorite podcast app so you never miss an episode. You can find out more about Andrew and how he helps corporates navigate a disruptive digital world with keynote speeches and C-suite workshops delivered in person or virtually at actionablefuturist.com. Until next time, this has been the Actionable Futurist Podcast.